Blog Talk Radio.
That was Stan Kenton, recorded in 1965 in a jazz concert. This week we are featuring the great arrangements and sounds of what I thought was the best modern big band jazz sound that was ever created, and that was the Stan Kenton Orchestra. This is Getting It Done, and I am your host, Dr. Walter Dean. Let me tell you a little bit about Kenton. He was born in 1911 and passed on at the age of 67. That was 1979. He He was a pianist, composer, arranger, a band leader, and I feel he truly influenced the orchestra jazz sound from the 1940s up until the late 1960s. Kenton was one of the pioneers in the field of jazz education, creating a jazz campus or camp in 1959 at the Indiana University. I can't say enough about this gentleman because I've had a lot of occasion to listen to most of his music. The three biggest bands I've found to be the most important ones, not counting the Dorseys and Harry James and that group, but then the swing era. But we go on to Duke Ellington and Count Basie, and Stan Kenton is in that mix some particular way. But he was a great jazz pianist. He was an average pianist, but really a fantastic arranger. And what we're going to do is we're going to listen to another jazz musician, singer, talk to you about Stan Kenton and see if you can know who this particular gentleman is.
This was not an easy road. You may not feel you like his kind of big band jazz, modern music, or progressive jazz. Have your choice in what you call it, but listen, and listen carefully. Did you know that this is Kenton? Those who have flatly refused to accept this entitled soliloquy as jazz. Kenton insists it is the jazz of the era. Perhaps more classical in nature, but of the jazz conception because it is played by jazz musicians. Another example, Solitaire. Every time there are men whose special role it is to give expression to the spirit of their dead, they become its symbols, each in his own field of art. Stan Kenton is such an individual, the symbol of a vibrant world that finds its voice today in jazz. His story is, in many ways, the story of modern jazz, and this musical era is his. There are many types and different likes and dislikes in music, and there are many different segments and sections of jazz music. There are those that prefer Dixieland music and ragtime, and there are those who said nothing can happen better for jazz after swing music. Then there are those that came along in recent years, the beboppers and the progressive fans, until today the modern end of the development of jazz is simply called modern music or modern jazz. It's a rather mystifying thing because somehow no one is ever able to describe it or give a justification for the music. It intrigues us. All we know is there's a wonderful feeling and a lot of excitement when five trumpets line up with five trombones, five saxophones and a rhythm section, and everything starts to swing. Thank you. Orchestra, Kenton, the title Swing House. Jazz musicians have developed a great deal since the old jazz started 60 or 70 years ago in the South. The first crude forms were very genuine and emotional content, had great character, and they have developed throughout the years in a technical way. Musicians today play great fluent phrases where before it were short, stammering things, but nevertheless the sincerity was still there and the character equal. Kenton has said, "That is one of the worries today, where musicians are so held down with creating things technically that sometimes they have to be on guard for sincerity. The emotional content must be genuine, or they have created nothing." Jazz music started in New Orleans and then crept up the river into Chicago. And from there, it spread all over the United States, and it kept spreading. Today, jazz music is internationally accepted and respected. Kenton has changed public taste in jazz. Grueling, ceaseless work has been the price of his success. He often goes without sleep while on tour. He'll do 2 concerts a day, sit for interviews, rehearse, travel, compose, and live music for 48 and often 72 hours before admitting the need for rest. People who only a few years ago found his music strange and noisy are in his audience today. Now, from his new recorded work, The Kenton Era, he speaks of the development of his music.
You know, in a comparative manner, the growth of the Kenton Orchestra has been, in a small way, a representative pattern in a certain period in the progress of jazz. And in the album of music to follow, you may see this pattern in detail as you hear the documentary evidence of all of our struggles to grow from then until now. With us, as I reminisce about the beginnings, there was an experimental rehearsal with 11 musicians in Los Angeles in 1940. I believed in the musicians I had called, and they reflected enough positive reaction to the music I had written to urge me further. At the top, there were bands like Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, Artie Shaw, the Lunsford Band, and of course, Duke Ellington. In our first public appearances in 1941, our jazz, like that of the big names, was fitted with the dance music. You know, in that era, people stood and listened, or they danced. Because none of the jazz at that time was too complex rhythmically for dance music. It was the beginning of the jitterbugs, and they, as well as most of the dancers, they liked to beat. So at the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa Beach, California, with men like Jack Ordean, Red Doris, Chico Alvarez, and Howard Rumsey, we played a music that sounded like this. There were a lot of sharp accent offbeats, Many improvised solos and most introductions, endings, and interludes were like powerful brass fanfare. I guess we played at top pitch all the time because, well, we were young and I'm sure we wanted to be noticed. Three years followed this, with not much progress musically or otherwise. We, like all other young jazz orchestras, were either too loud, too fast, too slow, or worse yet, what we were playing sounded like nonsense because there were no popular songs and we were very short on hit parade material. We made many trips from the Palladium in Hollywood to the Meadowbrook in Jersey, the Panther Room in Chicago, and stops in between. We had our share of cancellations, criticisms, and I guess we had our average amount of abuse, but as I look back on it now, I realize that what we were having was actually just considered normal growing pains. During this period, we tried many types of music and experimented continually in an effort to appease the ballroom men, the hotel operators, agents, radio networks, our recording company, and of course, the music publishers. Forgetting about the jazz format for the moment, we tried to create a sweet commercial style. We had Gene Howard singing the ballad.
There's such an air of spring.
We had Anita Day doing the rhythm tunes.
Like a stab in the back, she found out they were not
her. And I guess the few contributions we made to jazz during that period, well, maybe the most important was Eager Beaver. Confusion, I realized that two important developments had taken place. First, though we had drifted far from our course and struggled continually for simple survival, we had weathered the heaviest storm, that of getting started. And second, our attempts at musical appeasement would never be the answer. Though the band was now past the dangers of infancy, I knew we should never go further unless we returned to our original purpose, jazz. We relieved the library of every gimmick experiment and started blowing again with the same conscientiousness that we had in the beginning. And as if by magic, interest in the music, instead of hanging apathetically, began to soar. September 1945 found us at the Cafe Rouge in the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York. The band had grown in personnel. Now we had four trumpets instead of three, and of course we had four trombones instead of two. Once again, we were working with brass and the great excitement that comes from brass. You know, the wonderful Woody Herman Band at that time had just been accepted by the people playing the most exciting jazz, thereby rekindling our belief and enthusiasm in our own conception of music. So, again, with men like Eddie Safransky, Kay Wendy, Buddy Childers, Vito Musso, Boots Mazzulli, and of course, June Festi, we contributed artistry jumps. Painted rhythm. Tampico, and then came our first album, Artistry and Rhythm. In a year or so, we started breaking attendance records and our record sales became big. This continued until the spring of 1947, when gratified by the public's enthusiasm, but utterly exhausted, we dissolved the band for a 6 months rest. By now, the music of Artistry and Rhythm was firmly established. I began to realize the vast possibilities of the sound of the jazz musician. With Kay Winning's trombone, for instance, we found that we could create great character even without the presence of a rhythm section setting a beat. A good example was the sound created on Gene Roland's Ain't No Misery in Me. This to me opened a new field. We now had complete freedom with the jazz emotion. We could write our music in any movement because Besides setting it to a swing beat, we had the advantages of gaining contrast and freshness even without tempo. So in 1947, with the addition of Shelly Mann, Lorenzo Almeida, Milt Bernhardt, Ray Wetzel, Jack Costanza, George Weidler, and of course Bob Cooper, our music that was now called progressive jazz managed to succeed in our first concert tour and our first album of the music. That was Rubello's Impressionism. The concerto to end all concertos. The Cuban influence became prevalent in Cuban Carnival and Machito. Then there was Elegy for Aldo and, of course, many others. The enthusiasm for progressive jazz renewed our faith in the necessity to keep moving forward with our music. Concerts were strained financially and required periodic returns to hotels and ballrooms to help support them. But the interest of our listeners was unmistakable, and our own integrity demanded that this interest be justified and encouraged. Believing in the importance of jazz as an expression of the American people, we inaugurated a series of concerts in 1950 known as Innovations in Modern Music. With every conceivable advantage offered by 40 musicians, including strings, horns, and woodwinds, our music took on almost a classical aspect. While it was still jazz, we brought in the formally educated creative talent of such men as Franklin Marks, Johnny Richards, Bob Grettinger, and of course again Pete Rubello, and presented to the serious jazz listener such widely varied compositions as Trajectories, Soliloquy, Incident in Jazz, and of course Mirage. We cannot honestly ignore the fact that public acceptance of the more modern jazz expressions is still, to a large degree, a limited one. Our music, as well as the rest of modern jazz, is further and further away from popular music. And because it has become more complex, it has lost favor with some. So to encourage the development of the music itself and the taste of our audience for the music, we now create, orchestrate, and perform three distinct idioms. The lighter, more popular type of music. Modern jazz, which is in a constant state of growth. And the very advanced music that is highly experimental. Even in the popular idiom, we are constantly seeking new and fresh means of expressing this music which has such universal appeal. To cease to do so would be to cease to grow, and I believe sincerely that our organization lives only by growth and by development. It is too early yet to attempt to ascertain whether our efforts over the years have contributed to the development of the world's music. I feel it is probably enough to know that in the most exciting period music has ever known, we are at least a part of one ingredient necessary to its technical and emotional growth, this being jazz. There is Prologue, the story in brief of a musician and his orchestra, the man, Stan Kenton. This is Frank Sinatra, and this program is called The Kenton Era. Born in Wichita, Kansas, on February 19, 1912, Stan Kenton lived briefly in Colorado and was raised on the West Coast. Stan's mother, a piano teacher, began early to give him lessons, but it was only after testing trumpet, sax, and banjo that he returned to piano, the instrument of success.
After graduation from school, the ensuing depression years found him staging the fight for survival. He played piano in clubs and worked part-time with name and local bands from Bakersfield to San Diego. He spent many, many sleepless nights creating a completely different style that was later to become known as Artistry and Rhythm. He soon married, found movie studio and radio work, and eventually became assistant musical director and pianist arranger at Earl Carroll's in Hollywood. Throughout those lean 1930s, his dream was an orchestra of his own. This was realized when Kenton, on Memorial Day 1941, opened at the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa, California. Then as now, his theme, Artistry and Rhythm, 1941 vintage.
Well, it's the Balboa bandwagon with Stanley Kenton, Artistry and Rhythm.
Kenton felt a personalized sympathy toward jazz. Even in the small band, he believed he could make a serious musical contribution. Even within the scope of the popular song, he felt he could create a kind of depth which would be more complete than what had been done before. This was the beginning of his own music. It was a proud leader in his orchestra. The Young Kenton Band of Balboa in 1941 was an immediate success. Criticism, it was tempered by one fact. The Kenton Band interested people. The youngsters turned out. Business was healthy. Oh, yes, in those days he sang too.
Now I went down to St. James and Cambridge, and I found my baby there.
What was he doing, man?
She was stretched out on a cold, cold white table.
What is that white table doing,
Papa? So sweet, so cold.
After his engagement at Balboa, one night as followed. Prospects were impressive. Finances were low. What he thought was a string of one-nighters turned out to be for weekends only. Then a fortunate break. A booking at the famous Palladium in Hollywood. Variety in the Billboard said, an attraction has been on the West Coast. Next stop, New York, an eight-week engagement at Roseland, the famous Dimer Dance Hall. The critics, operators, dancers all said, no. Kenton's happy music and unusual presentation, the success in California, had failed in New York. Pleasing everyone in music was difficult. He tried supplementing pop and standard tunes for the library. He tried to tone the band down, tried to compromise. Slowly there was success, but he decided to stand or fall on his original convictions. Jazz as he heard it and felt it. Critical acceptance improved gradually. In 4 years, Kenton had become famous. The pressure of the times and of success itself kept him moving. Broadcasts, rehearsals, auditions, and shows for the armed forces, constant changes in personnel. Success at the Paramount Theater in New York.
By 1946, the band was at its height. The annual polls named Artistry and Rhythm the most popular music of the year. But the band and Stan were weary. 5 long years of constant hard work. Stan announced he was disbanding. The Artistry and Rhythm era ended. After months of rest, recuperation, and thought, he grew lonesome to hear the sound again, the pulse of the band. It had to continue. Being a concert attraction fascinated him. If this could be successful now, Stan hoped in the future to develop the idea with a larger orchestra. The concert experiment was tried at his original location of success, the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa. A new era had begun, success again, and he entitled it Progressive Jazz. Nothing Stan ever did prove more successful. Slotted along with regular ballroom bookings were the concerts, from the Academy of Music in Philadelphia to Carnegie Hall in New York. The public now accepted the new effort. Variety magazine said, Kenton's success is based on his constant striving for new paths in music and the band's excellent understanding of it. Playing concerts and dance engagements, the band worked its way west. Kenton's progressive jazz with vocalist June Christie drew 15,000 people in the famous Hollywood Bowl. All the hopes and effort that had gone into his music were, to him, justified by this acceptance. On dance days, the enthusiastic audiences asked and listened to both dance and the progressive side of the music. 15 months of one-nighters and concerts from coast to coast. The men were tired. Physically and emotionally, Kenton had driven himself day after day to the point of exhaustion. For the moment, he had lived enough music. He needed rest, time to reevaluate his beliefs. When he ended the last progressive concert, the Kenton organization was, according to the theatrical trades, the biggest box office aggregation in the country. Kenton's progressive jazz era, though, had ended.
That was Frank Sinatra and Stan Kenton himself talking about and giving you a rundown about the history of how he got started and how he eventually ended up. I'm going to go back and sort of express a few other things that maybe were left out. But we're not mentioned, I guess I was going to try to say. First of all, that Stan Kenton was influenced in high school by listening to none other than the great Satchmo, Louis Armstrong. Another thing that happened that I found to be very, very interesting, and remarkably in 1943 and 44, he heard the sounds of Jimmy Lunsford and Benny Carter, and they greatly influenced how his music eventually sounded. His arrangements around that particular time actually lost him a job that he had working for the Bob Hope radio show, and his arrangements were not what Bob Hope wanted, so he and Bob Hope went at it for a while until he finally left it replaced by none other than Les Brown, who was a person who eventually ended up playing and was influenced by Kenton. Kenton had some great musicians himself with him and that he influenced and that eventually went on to become great on their own. Let me read a few of these to you. Stan Getz, saxophone, tenor. Art Pepper, alto saxophone. Anita O'Day, a great singer who was able to sing 3 octaves. Pete Rugolo, who was his arranger, but also could play music himself. June Christie, a singer, one of the very first singers that he had. Chris Connors, Shirley Mann. Oh, by the way, Chris Connors was a singer also. Shirley Mann was a drummer, and you might remember him from The Man with the Golden Arm that Frank Sinatra participated in that after he won an Academy for the movie he did From Here to Eternity. Then you had Jerry Mulligan on baritone saxophone, Bud Shank on alto saxophone, Shorty Rogers, who was a band leader that you might have thought that Sinatra was playing and The Man with the Golden Arm, but Shirley Mann was playing. However, Shorty Rogers was the band leader in that particular movie. Shirley Rogers was one of the people who kept the West Coast jazz going, and he was a trumpet player. Bob Cooper, saxophone. Joe Green, saxophone. And none other than the great Maynard Ferguson, who was a trumpet player who played octaves way higher than anybody I have ever heard. In any event, that is about Stan, but we're going to let the remaining of the show listen. I want to have you listen to some of the things that he did, and some of the, and I will be cutting you off on certain songs so that we can get a lot of songs in. Here's Stan Kenton and his orchestra, and it's called Scene USA.
On the jazz in USA for over two decades. Our guest leader this evening, Stan Kenton, has been to jazz what Ernest Hemingway has been to literature, a vivid figure of creative excitement, innovation, and controversy. Stan's orchestra today is no less provocative and interprets our age of crises in terms of American jazz. Let's sample some Gintonia right now. Stan and the orchestra whip into Bill Holman's arrangement of the venerable standard, Limehouse Blues. Thank you.
Since the years of World War II, Stan Kenton has blazed trails in big band jazz. He has pushed forward the frontiers of music, and with the aid of many gifted arrangers who worked with him, he's revealed dimensions that were previously unknown to jazz. It used to be said of big band jazz that the soloist got all the glory while the arranger is working behind the scenes, got all the black coffee and the headaches. But a band is only as good as its writers. Suddenly, Stan Kenton Orchestra has revealed the talents of a bevy of Kent men whose contributions have enriched our world of jazz through the Kenton medium. Here are some of the notable arranger composers who have left their mark on the Kenton Orchestra and on jazz as well. This is Pete Rugolo. Here's the late Bob Grettinger. This is Jerry Mulligan, as talented with the pen as he is with the baritone sax. This is Johnny Richards, whose forte is in the Afro-Cuban vein. And Johnny, Robert Willis, Bill Holman here with Stan. And Gene Rowland. Over here, this is Lenny Niehaus, who wrote the arrangement, by the way, of our theme that was played by the orchestra at the opening of our show. Let me see, have I forgotten anyone? Almost left out the arranger of the next number you're going to hear. The song is the tender All the Things You Are. The arrangement is the work of a piano player.
Welcome to the jazz scene.
Thank you, Oscar.
It's wonderful to have you. I find this article by you in Downbeat magazine most interesting.
you make a point, man, that student musicians ought to have professional guidance if they're going to get anywhere in jazz. I think it's well taken, but why did you, with all the full-time jobs you have to do running this big band, decide to take on the additional work of operating jazz band clinics?
Well, Oscar, thank you. Just me, there are a number of us that are taking part. We felt that as great as the universities are, music and conservatories of music, that somehow there's something that they are leaving out or omitting, and that is the professional approach to the playing jazz music and the idea of making a living in music, and we feel that this is the thing that we're stressing at the camps and doing much good at the clinics.
Well, congratulations. You've helped renew many folks' faith in the future of jazz. What are you and the orchestra going to play for us next?
Well, we have an original composition that was composed by the drummer. He's quite a talented chap, you know, and he's written this composition. His name is Steve Barton. The name of the composition is The Waltz of the Prophets.
The Waltz of the Prophets. Okay, straight ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, I told you I was going to interrupt you, mainly because the clock on the wall is telling me we're getting to some closeness of closing the show out. And I wanted you to hear some other things that he did. But I wanted to mention in law school, I had an opportunity to meet Oscar Brown, who was actually the person who was discussing things with Stan Kenton in this particular segment. Here's Stan Kenton doing Omphalos in 1977, which I thought was a masterpiece of one of his. So let's listen to that.
In the very beginning days of this band, some years back, there were a few compositions that were written as kind of etudes, studies, so to speak. And there were four or five that were written especially for the saxophone section. A couple of three of them were recorded, and one gained a lot of popularity. It's one of the original things by the saxophone section. Here is now Opus and Pastels.
That was Stan Kenton, done in 1977, which was an original piece that done specifically for the saxophone section of his band. We've been listening to Getting It Done, and I'm your host, Dr. Walter Dean. One of the songs that I liked the best that he did, we may not have enough time to hear it all, but I'm going to play it and end the show with it being played. The name of the song is called What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life?
Thank you.
is Stan Kenton playing What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life? Recorded in 1970, live at John Parks, playing alto saxophone solo, featuring the great John Parks. Peter Eskine is on the drums, Stan Kenton's on the piano. What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life? Live in 1970 in London. Magnificent sound. So I've boosted trembles diligently with the cool edit program. Made tapes hiss louder, but improved daily. What can I say about this fantastic arrangement, which I like the best of all of the What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life songs that I've heard, besides, of course, singing that myself. Next week, we'll either continue with Stan Kenton, because there's so much music of his that I'd like for you to hear, or we'll move on to another great jazz pianist, Al Jamal. So here, from here to here, this is Dr. Walter Dean from Getting It Done. Hopefully you enjoyed the show.